Hi, my name is Ragnar Tómas from Iceland Review. Today we'll be sitting down with Bergur Ebbi and Snorri Helga from the popular podcast Fílalag. How are you guys doing?
Very good,
yeah.
And you?
Yeah,
pretty good. Today was, or yesterday was the first day of summer in Iceland. Did you do anything special to celebrate?
Just a normal thing, go to the pool and yeah, I barbecued, yeah. That's maybe something special because of summer, yeah.
That's like an absolute must to pull out the barbecue.
I was visiting the president yesterday.
Okay.
Well, not really the president. There was a reception at Bessastaði.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah, there is a program taking place right now, which is actually initiated and run by the First Lady, Eliza Reid, called Iceland Writers Retreat. I'm just a part of one event in that program.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of mostly foreigners at Bessastaði yesterday. It was a fun treat.
She's been doing this for a long time.
For 10 years.
Before she was First Lady.
Yeah. It's a very cool thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Was there a barbecue?
No. There were just this in these fancy receptions. There's always the fancier the reception is, the more tightly they portion the or ration the food.
Yeah.
They're so small the bites you get.
Yeah.
But they're quite tasty, or you know, they're okay, and desserts and all kinds. And if you would really have the intention, you could
get a whole meal.
Yeah. But it would just require like a dedication.
Mm. A doggy bag maybe.
Yeah.
So we joined you earlier in April for the 10th anniversary of Fílalag, which is quite an amazing feat. I just wanted to begin with, you know, asking about the origin story. How did, do you remember the conversation that you had? How did this come about, if we rewind the clock back in time?
Yeah. Yes, it's really, well, me and Bergur used to be in a band together, like 15 years ago. And we spent a lot of time just talking about, and we're both, you know, very interested in pop music history and the stories behind the musicians and how music is made, and just like the circumstances where it was made and how everything, like the whole package, you know, that's we always talked like that, you know, just been really interested in stuff like that. And it was like this one, in particular, one song that Bergur kind of turned me on to Bruce Springsteen with this song. It's a song called Racing in the Streets. From Darkness on the Edge of Town, and we used to like meet up and like hanging out and drinking whiskey and whatever, and just we would go through this song like line by line and talk, like go over everything, like pretty much what we do in the podcast.
And this is what we believe that a lot of people do,
yeah,
you know, without having it formalized.
Yeah.
And it's similar to what is sometimes referred to as like a plutokinning, is like where one person is like introducing a whole record or maybe one song or some music, piece of music to his peer, his friend. Something obviously that has always been done, but this is
like trying to hype everything up and like selling it. That's kind of the thing. And then there was like a group of friends or people around us that were talking about starting podcasts in Iceland, in Icelandic. It didn't exist 10 years ago.
Right.
So there was some people that were pooling together to set up like a channel to distribute it.
Yeah. Under.
So they were asking people if anybody was interested. And I had the idea to just try to record a conversation between me and Bergur about Racing in the Streets, that Bruce Springsteen song, and that's the first episode of Fílalag.
Right.
We just tried that and it worked, so we're like, okay, let's try another song, let's see what happens. And that's like 10 years ago and like 300 plus episodes.
Yeah, I mean it's almost like an episode per week for 10 years, right?
That's we were pretty busy, but still
it was pretty much like that until maybe 2 years ago when we started doing the theater thing, and then the TV show. We took a little break from the regular podcasting, but now we're up and running again with that weekly episodes.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think what really drives the experience is the chemistry that you two share. When did you, do you remember when you first met?
Well, not maybe the, because we were from the same neighborhood, so we kind of probably met when we were like 6 or 7 or something. Yeah. I just don't remember it. And our brothers were in the same class in school, so we kind of, you know, knew of each other for a long time. But that it wasn't until high school that we kind of got to know each other a little bit. Yeah. And not until really after high school that we started the band, you know, and got to be close. You know,
it's a long time.
Yeah,
yeah, and I knew his siblings before him, and yeah. And all his clan.
Yeah.
Well, what neighborhood is this?
Hlíðar.
In the Hlíðar, yeah. Okay, yeah, excellent. I think am I right in saying that? I mean, Fílalag started right before sort of the big podcasting wave in Iceland.
We had probably like 2 years, you know, before really started going, because then it just exploded. Then right. Everybody had the podcast, and now that's, I think, my feeling is that it's kind of slowing down again, you know.
Yeah, I guess it is just what do you call it, like concentrating now, or
yeah.
You know,
yeah, maybe
some would say like even it's starting to be more incorporated, like, you know, because different. And popular podcasts are now under the domain of media companies. Mm. And I think this heyday of like just lots of independent podcasts is maybe over. But we've been for most of the time fairly indifferent to that culture in general. Yeah. I mean, but obviously I think it's just very good that people are consuming podcasts more and they are turning more and more onto this, but mm-hmm. we've just been doing our thing and not really been so conscious of other podcasts or how they are doing.
No,
we quite quickly got like a core following of people that obviously has maybe like expanded a little bit through the years. And it's just like with so many things, I think it's important just to also concentrate on talking to someone, and we were lucky enough to have our core following. Mm-hmm. And then everybody who's interested can tune in or tune out however they wish to do that.
Yeah. And how long do you think you'll keep this up? Just
no idea. And it's always kind of, because this idea, because it's music and everybody loves music, and it's a very simple idea, and you can apply it to different types and formats. You know, so that I was talking earlier that we've been doing these events in the theater, and of course these kind of more laid back, loose live events that you were attending.
Yeah,
and when we've done 2 seasons of the TV show, and we can like see, you know, trying like to put this idea, you know, in all kinds of different mm-hmm. formats. You know, even talking about doing a book, or you mm-hmm. know, even a, what's it called, a board game or whatever. You know, you could do like all kinds of things just with this general idea that mm-hmm. feel evolves around.
You know? There have some aesthetics that have developed around it, mostly obviously just text and spoken words, you know, but still there are some, those are still, you know, rhetorical devices that we use that can be applied to different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wanted to discuss that further. I mean, you have this very, let's say, unique way of using language, maybe starting with, you know, the title of the show, Fílalag. Mm-hmm. And Fíla, I mean, my sense is that it comes from the English of feel.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about, Fílalag is, it's about digging a song, really vibing with something. And I actually had the privilege of translating the TV show for Ruth.
Yeah, of course. It was very well done.
Thank you. I hadn't received any feedback, but I understand from Alan or a mutual friend that you guys are okay with it. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. I settled on the idea, the word dick, you know, to really dick something is like a slangy way of capturing, like, mm-hmm. you know, when you really want to feel mm-hmm. feel something. And but I mean, you've kind of, I mean, popularized this maybe, or at least pushed it further than, you know, its previous usage. And maybe for our foreign audience, it's useful to just get a handle on the word itself. I mean, what does it mean to you to really feel like? What is that? Mm-hmm. Can you explain it to
It's been around as a slang in Icelandic, I think, for decades.
Yeah.
I think at least, you know, from the 60s and probably even before that.
Yeah.
And obviously just an English slang, but it means something different than to feel in English, which is a very general term. And Icelandic, I think it is when you have a very individual and unique connection to something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like a general feeling. It's more like a...
Yeah, it's also, I mean, it also can apply to like food and whatever, you know, what kind of types of food you like and whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And actors or whatever, you know, it's like...
Everything that is...
that you can have an opinion on, really.
That's up to taste.
Yeah, that's up to taste.
You can... So the feeling to feel is yeah. If it is a matter of taste,
mm-hmm.
then you can apply it. But it's been used a lot in music, I think.
Yeah.
And... Yeah, but I mean, obviously, it's been, yeah, it's a pretty general slang in Icelandic.
Yeah.
And I mean, you do have a pretty special way of using language. I mean, there are a lot of words that you guys throw around commonly, and that listeners of Feel Alive will have sort of associate with the show. For example, "mullingur" is something that you guys use quite a bit, and probably my favorite word is "nof."
Yeah,
it's like I mean that comes up almost every episode.
Yeah.
And I mean I don't think I'd heard the word "norp" before I started listening to you guys.
Okay, right.
But I mean it means in English to basically stand outside and be cold.
Yeah. Kind of enduring cold weather.
Yeah, enduring cold weather.
Yeah.
And it was funny. I was listening to the latest episode this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously being fooled by the Icelandic summer, I was wearing a t-shirt and a denim jacket.
Yeah.
And then I was walking outside and I was like, fuck, it's cold. And at the same moment you guys were talking about "norpa," and I was like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah. Right. I think maybe it is true, especially because we have a little bit of, foreign audience here in this interview.
Yeah.
I think Fiddler is, in a way about the Icelandic experience as well in general.
Right.
Obviously mostly through music, but the Icelandic experience being obviously like a unique thing, but we have access to like the culture of the world. We are a part of the global, the stream of culture that
mm-hmm.
but we sometimes are, everything is just a little bit more difficult here. We have to apply ourselves more to and we're always kind of catching up.
Mm.
And because a lot of the stuff we talk about in the episodes is also comparison between Icelandic music and foreign music.
Yeah.
And the story of Icelandic music was for decades just keeping up.
Yeah.
And always being running a little bit, you know, late.
Yeah.
Behind, yeah.
Always a little bit behind. It wasn't really until the Sugar Cubes and the kind of post-punk movement that we caught up with the rest of the world.
And in special niche genres
there are exceptions, of course, but that's kind of, as a whole.
Where we managed to be in front, or at least, you know, in the vanguard.
Of the main, yeah.
Right, for at least some time, and maybe we have... But before that, we were always obviously catching up, and it's not only like with the fashion and subjective things, but it's also just we were just really getting equipment and instruments and we didn't have free media or free radio until the 80s, so everything was a lot of I think that the Icelandic experience when we are talking about the consumption of popular culture, we have a lot in common with maybe more developing countries or countries that used to be a part of the Eastern Bloc. And this is just something I found in conversations with people of my age coming from those countries. So we have this absolute adoration for certain things that are part of the of foreign culture, especially American and British culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because we couldn't completely be a part of it because we were isolated.
Right.
So we idolize it even more than We should.
Yeah, and it's also probably because Iceland is such a relatively young nation, you know, or even we've been around for 2,000 years, but as a liberated...
1,000?
Yeah. 1,000, I mean, yeah. But,
if there are tourists listening, we are lying enough to them on the streets. If you walk past the tour guides, they would say something like that. I would actually stop and just...
Yeah.
No, enough is enough.
Yeah. But we've been like...
1,100 years, right?
Yeah.
That's what they...
Close to 2,000.
Yeah.
But we've been, you know, it's because we just got... before 1945, 50, I mean, Iceland was just a really, really underdeveloped country, you know. Mm-hmm. But then it got super rich, super fast. Mm-hmm. And people... we've been trying to, this is what I'm talking about, like, catching up to... Mm-hmm. The cultural standards of the countries that we want to compare ourselves to, mm-hmm. and trying to kind of figure it out really fast, because we feel like we deserve to be compared to Britain, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. America, which is crazy, because it's also just so few of us, you know, it's just a tiny population, but we have a big ego, you know.
Yeah. And I think it's especially like my father's generation, you know, born in the 50s and 60s. I mean, mm-hmm. you could really feel how they looked so, you know, to the West and to America, especially mm-hmm. in Britain, mm-hmm. Especially because the context of the Cold War, I think many Icelanders sided firmly with the States, with mm-hmm. Sort of democratic republics. And there's just this real like adoration and love for like, you know, the pop music of America and Britain, mm-hmm. which is maybe to a greater extent in Iceland than in other places, maybe. I think that's...
I think that is maybe the case, because we didn't have maybe as... we didn't have as many other things to lean on, like in other countries, obviously, with more infrastructure in culture, like hundreds of years of music. Classical music and opera and all these things. When popular culture, when pop music hit, or rock and roll music, whatever, in the post-World War II era, it was really hitting like a vacuum or a void when it came here. I mean, we had some tradition, of course, with music and things, but it was really, you were really like feeding, I think, a very starving beast that didn't have anything else to consume. And I think that a lot of interesting things have happened in this small country, maybe both because of these circumstances, because I don't believe that genetically or anything, people are more creative here than anywhere else, because I think that is a conversation that just leads to strange assumptions about countries and nations. But I think because of circumstances and because of a lot of... maybe the lack of a lot of nice... and pleasant things, we need to be creative and need to kind of spin ourselves out of situations. Mm-hmm. And music sometimes has been an outlet for people to express their frustration, and sometimes it seemed like a cry for help. And I think a lot of, and that's why maybe it happened in the punk and new wave era, that the Icelandic music kind of burst out, because It has a big resonance with the national identity, which is very strong, individualistic, and frustrated, and kind of maybe not so nuanced and sophisticated.
Right.
So that kind of struck
a chord.
And maybe one more thing about the language that you guys use, because I think you know, you have this, I would say, unique way of framing things, which I've noticed that, so I have a friend who is a longtime listener of Filalaq, and I've noticed that, like, when he's telling stories and anecdotes, or, you know, I noticed this a few years ago, it was like almost like he was adopting the Filalaq setup and framing when he was telling his stories, which is like, I mean, what you guys do so great is like, you know, you're talking about a song and how it was composed, and you're trying to put yourself into the shoes of the composer, and then you're imagining their surroundings, and you're like, oh yeah, and you're picturing the furniture, and, you know, filling in the blanks with all these really curious details. And it's just funny that, like, I feel like there's a certain group of people who've somehow picked up on this, like, tendency to describe things in this way. And it's, I mean, that's quite remarkable. Have you noticed this yourself? Like, when people, you know, maybe use like the Filalaq lexicon somehow, and saying, you know, he was there, it was wearing this really great leather jacket, and you know, like, and I imagine, you know, there were like pencil drawings scattered on the floor, and it's just like almost this like unique narrative style. Is this something that was like conscious, or did it just like, it was a product of you guys just spinning?
I don't think it was not conscious. It's just like, I was telling you about the Bruce Springsteen songs. That was, it's just like something that me and Bergur have always, we always talked like this, you know, we always, this has always been what we've been interested in and what we talk about when we meet up, you know. It's just been our kind of, the core of our friendship, you know, the these kind of, you know, speculations and you know, imagining things like this. So it was just very surprising when it caught on to so many, when we held our first live event, and we had, you know, because we never really, we were just always doing this for ourselves, didn't really have any idea if anybody was connecting with this and understood what we were trying to do, and but it was just like been packed, and always all the live events have been really well attended, and like you started to feel I get a sense of a real sort of community forming out of this.
But it is an interesting thing, the thing you described, because I feel like that there is so much texture to music or even other cultural mediums. There is so much texture that is sometimes left unsaid. There's so much rhetorics, there's so much signaling going on that we take for granted. But sometimes these, this extra texture is what really draws us to a thing. And if you just imagine a thing like a rock concert, I mean, it has to be something else than just you hearing the songs being played like very loud that draws you to that. There are so many things, just like the static noise before the concert starts,
the smells,
when, and the smells, and when they plug in their instruments and that kind of, and like the overall aesthetics, and these things are it's so interesting to explain all these things, because some of them have not been fully explained before, and it's always interesting when you talk about something that everybody has witnessed and sensed in some way but hasn't put into words.
Right.
But that said, it is interesting that music journalism used to be a very, very big thing. Like pop music journalism, rock and roll music journalism, obviously very closely related to the counterculture movement, started in the late 60s. Maybe the best example is just the Rolling Stone magazine.
Right. Yeah.
It started, I think, late 60s or early 70s, and similar counterparts in the UK. And you can also see that in records when they were released, the Rose notes accompanying them, the liner notes that are always abstract to the music. They're not really about.
Yeah.
And I feel like at some point, music journalism kind of faded out and started to be more less of an art form and less abstract, and just okay guys, so tell me, how long did it take you to record the record? And I've always felt that that kind of discussion about music is really stale, really just, it's really the enemy of creation and music.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about this here, because Icelandic Review is maybe one of the few places where, you know, you have a subject matter and you have time to, you know, work the subject matter adequately and stay with it, so that you can attend, say, a live event, and then you can speak to someone who's involved in the event, and you can do these interviews. And I mean, that was really the heart and soul of journalism and music journalism in the 60s, where you had people like Lester Bangs and people who really just so passionate about the music, and they would make note of smells, the sounds, the character quirks, and you would get these character descriptions and what it's like being at a concert, which is missing these days, sadly. I mean, it's usually, you know, email correspondences between a journalist and this really kind of, I mean, it's about the music, but not really. And I mean, like you say, a big part of consuming music and art is, you know, all these unseen elements that you maybe don't really think about.
Yeah.
And I think that's also, I mean, what I love about your podcast is that, to me, it sounds like it's founded on the simple premise of, well, if you spend enough time looking at something, you know, it becomes interesting.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's always the case when you talk about a song, even though maybe the song that comes up in the title, I'm like, oh, I don't really like that song. Mm-hmm. But I know that, you know, having listened to you guys talk about it and really delve into the lyrics and the music and the atmospheres, you always walk away with a greater appreciation for it. Mm. And I had this experience during COVID. I started this like sort of project for myself where I decided to start from the year 1900 and work my way through time and try to find the best song published each year.
Oh, yeah.
An ambitious project that kind of faded with time.
Yeah.
But there were so many experiences where, you know, just finding a song, reading about it, learning about how it came about, really just changed my experience with it and just elevated it to, you know, the same thing that you guys are doing.
Yeah.
I can feel it so much stronger. And in particular with Massive Attack, Teardrop.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the history of that? With like the Madonna connection? And
No,
it was like, it was written for Madonna, but then two of the three members thought that someone else should sing it.
Okay.
And they settled on, don't remember.
Right.
The song, the singer who actually came in and recorded it, but she recorded the lyrics when she was dating Jeff Buckley.
Yeah.
And she found out that he was missing on the day that she recorded the song.
I just heard this recently.
Yeah. It's just like, you know, just knowing this about the song makes it so much more powerful. And, and I think that's the lovely thing about Filalai is that, you know, there's always this promise of, you know, okay, you may not like this song on the surface that we're going to play today, but, mm-hmm. you know, give us some time to talk about it and you're going to be invested in it.
Yeah, we have a rule. There's only one rule. We have to like the song ourselves. It cannot be kind of I mean, we have to have, and both of us, it's not supposed to be like one really likes it and is trying to sell the other one.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously we like it in different ways, but we truly have to have some connection to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we don't really try to sell it to the, I think, listener either. We just assume, you know, it's that kind of, it's like, you know, when a car salesman is just assuming, of course you like this car, of course you like, you know,
yeah.
I think that is rather the, but it's very interesting what you say about just the time spent on a subject.
Yes.
Equals sometimes how much you care about it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And in the end, that is just a definite metric to everything. And there are obviously, you can say so many negative things about our culture with technology and everything, that our attention span is getting shorter. But there is this contradiction still that even though a lot in social media makes our attention span shorter, and there are even some experiments that show for that, I suppose.
Yeah.
There are some elements also in the latest technology and the cultural changes that have come with it that have completely exploded further or former proved ideas of how much time we can spend on a thing.
Yeah.
If you think about it, and podcasts would be an example where a subject can get a laser focus for a very long time, which was not possible in regular media. It was not possible really in books because of, I mean, obviously because, you know, the new technology is not finite like the other mediums. So
yeah.
it's a logistical thing. But also, in the end, I think it just shows that all these ideas that we are programmed for this and this and that, I've never really subscribed to any ideas like that. That we are primates that have the attention span to do this or that, and now we're manipulating towards this. I think we are a very adaptable brains, and we are just capable of, and I've been so curious about, because we spent an hour or so talking about each song.
Yeah.
So I've been curious about what happens like after 2 hours or 3 hours.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously our kind of scheme does not really, it would probably not be so good, but I think I would dare somebody else to try to.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's in the books, you know, a special extended version of Editor's Cut of Filalai where you just spend 12 hours talking about
something. People are really digging into things now, like the Beatles-ology or whatever you could call it. They're really, really digging into specific things about the history of.
Yeah, I mean, there was a. there's a podcast that's still running today where they, I think there's two guys who they cover every Tom Waits song ever released.
Yeah.
And they've done like, I don't know how many songs he's released, but
yeah,
yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that wouldn't have been possible in the past, just spending so much time with it.
And you will find an audience because it, obviously that, for example, is a niche, but still, I mean, because it's a global thing, you could probably have more monthly listeners to that than
a lot of
something very general. So people in this medium, you can play around a lot with that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also there's something struck me while attending the show in April earlier was that, you know, this is probably a unique moment in history where people pay money to sit down somewhere and just listen to two people have a conversation. I don't think that has probably never happened ever in the history of the band.
that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
People are and part of it is because people are meeting like-minded people, I suppose, because they listen to the same thing, and and also shows that the idea of entertainment, as in that it has to be very packed with gimmicks, that's not really the case. People are just
And do you prepare differently for live shows, presumably, than normal episodes, or
it's pretty similar.
Yeah, we needed to prepare extra in the theater.
Yeah, in the theater we had also photos and video clips. And stuff
we,
like that.
We kind of, you know, because when you're in a theater, and I know this so well from because I perform a lot in stand-up and things, one of the benefits is that you just kind of run the same program over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But we, you know, we don't feel good about that. And it's not a question of that we are hoping that people come, you know, back, you know, every time.
No.
Because I think for the most part, we just had different audiences all the time. Except for some crazy fans that showed up to all of them. But we had to prepare a new song for each. It was almost like a premiere every night.
Yeah.
But it wasn't so many times. This is just a few times over the winter.
And for listeners who don't know, we're referring to the Philharmonic Special with the symphony orchestra.
Now we are referring to the one in the City Theater.
Oh, in the City Theater. Yeah,
we ran there for 2 years, but it was during COVID, so there were only like four shows each year or something.
It wasn't like a
really long lasting show, but. But then the thing we did with the symphony.
Yeah, that was a lot of preparation for that.
Yeah.
That was because that couldn't be fully improvised. You know, we need to, because the band can't, or the orchestra can't
improvise.
You have to have cues. And then just like everything needs to be printed 2 months before and whatever, you know.
So our main concern for a preparation like that is to try to prepare less. So it's kind of a contradiction because we need to be part of, to kind of approve or like, you know, to quality control our end of the thing. We need to have some kind of improvisation. So we needed to leave room for that. And we needed to prepare a whole lot to be able to improvise.
Yeah. That was the thing. We needed to kind of like read a lot and memorize everything.
Yeah.
So we could do it, you know, feel confident about just going up there and doing
stuff. But I heard once that was the best way to prepare radio. This is something that Jón Múli Árnason said.
Okay.
The best way to improvise is to prepare really well.
Yeah.
Have everything prepared.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I felt that as like a journalist, as an interviewer, if, you know, if you have memorized your list of questions so thoroughly and you have all the facts straight in your head, then you can be... you can improvise and you can, you know, when someone says something, you could take, even though your interview has maybe a structure, you're still able to sort of work around it. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to share one insight that I've had with regard to music, maybe it's like a kind of epiphany 3 or 4 years ago. I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. And maybe this is too abstract and weird, but I'm going to go for it anyway. So I have this idea that, human beings are emotional creatures and we experience negative and positive emotions. And then we have ways of dealing with those emotions. When it comes to the negative emotions, we have things like cognitive behavioral therapy, which is like founded on Stoicism, which is about sort of contextualizing bad emotions and changing our patterns of thought to make them more bearable, easier to live with. So it's like using language maybe as a way of, you know, coping. Mm-hmm. But then for me, music is almost on the opposite end of the spectrum in the way that it, you know, it can really tease out good emotions and mm-hmm. positive emotions that sometimes are subdued by, you know, the mundane facts of living. You know, for example, like love, if you've been with someone for a very long time, I mean, the thrill and the excitement wears off. And then when you have kids, I mean, everything becomes more of a kind of a routine company almost that you're managing. But then music, you know, has this incredible power of intensifying those emotions that maybe have abated, or, you know, you don't feel as strongly as you once did. Mm-hmm. And I mean, maybe this isn't something that we think about as teenagers when we're full of emotion and energy, but maybe as I've grown older, music has come to serve this almost weird role in, mm-hmm. in coping. And I think that's what Fila does well, is by contextualizing the process of writing and putting everything into context and focusing on the details, it helps to sort of turn the lever on how, you know, powerful the music can be mm-hmm. by knowing the backstory. Does this resonate mm-hmm. with you at all, this kind of
definitely
thinking? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's also, you know, me and, as I said earlier, me and Berger used to be in a band together, and we're both the songwriters, write songs ourselves. And the way I've always kind of connected with music is I, when I find something that I like, I want to know everything about it, like where does it come from? What is this? You know,
yeah.
And then to know the backstories and everything like that, to kind of map it, and that's how I can kind of understand it. So it's always been really kind of that's always been a bit really big part of my understanding of music, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, like for me, because I'm a musician still, and it's like my only way of really expressing myself, and like that's so there's a big part of just my emotional life, just it revolves around music, you know. Mm-hmm. Just still do it, like when I go for a run or whatever, to give you, put some music on to motivate you and whatever.
Right.
While I'm cooking, you know, mm-hmm. I put some music on to just a certain type of music, where, you know, when I'm cooking certain types of food and whatever, just to enhance the experience, you know.
Right.
Just to mm-hmm. put everything to get my blood flowing, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Get my juices flowing. Get my mm-hmm. get my head spinning. You know.
Yeah.
That's what I've always done. Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And as a musician, do you think that the Fila-like experience has sort of changed the way you compose or write, or has it informed your process?
Well, it's just, it does the same thing. It just keeps my head going, you know. Because we're always talking for, you know, to sit down with Berger for an hour, you know, just talk and try to fully understand something. It just gives you a lot of, brain food, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah. One thing that I've noticed is, and obviously this is a subjective thing, but
yeah.
this is my understanding. It seems that musicians in general, and now I'm comparing them to people that have other mediums or other art forms,
yeah.
like actors or visual artists. Or it seems that musicians, they are the smartest bunch. They are, and they are the best in using words and conversation and expressing ideas and emotions in interviews. They seem to, and obviously with a whole lot of exceptions,
yeah.
but it seems that when you get a musician down in an interview to talk about things, it seems that there's something about that medium that they seem to be very, have a very logical have a very good balance between logic and emotions
yeah.
in their delivery of thoughts and ideas,
mm-hmm.
able to construct, and the best preparation for an episode, at least that I do, is just to listen to interviews to the artist,
yeah,
and they are so insightful.
Mm-hmm.
And they can teach you so many things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, somehow very human oftentimes. Like,
yeah, very human and just very articulate as well.
Yeah.
Very good with words very often, even though they're not.
I mean, it might be like somebody like Liam Gallagher. You
know? Yeah.
He's
yeah.
very good with words.
Yeah.
He's very, I mean, I wouldn't call him stupid, but he's kind of, he's a lad, you know.
Yeah.
Just, but, and then you have, you know, Bob Dylan on the other spectrum, who's yeah. like a very intellectual guy and very conceptual. But they're both very valid. That's like just like to watch an interview with these guys, you get, you can get, it can really inspire you and really teach you a lot, you know.
And popular music is such a great art form because it contains so much. It needs, obviously, I mean, it needs arrangement, and a lot of thought has to be put into the concept and
yeah.
arranging the music. And obviously it needs that initial spark of a good melody and rhythm and everything. And so craftsmanship and delivering it. And then it needs a story, usually, because most of them go with lyrics. And I actually think that is essential with rock and roll music. It needs to be poetic.
Right.
It needs to have, and not just any lyrics, it needs to have like an original spark of thought.
Mm.
And you need to be kind of versed in all these different things if you are a successful rock and roll musician. And this is something, you don't need that kind of, you don't need that 360 package for some other art forms. Some other art forms have been the victims of industrialization in the sense that, you know, they are people specialize in one thing and they get very good at it. I think popular music is not like that. I think you just can't. Like, there's no formula or code to crack it. You just kind of need to have your antennae spread all over.
Yeah, you need to be, like you say, versed in so many disciplines almost. I mean, you have to be a storyteller, you have to be a...
And you need to be very connected to what is happening.
Right.
To be able to tell a story that resonates.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's fascinating. I wanted also to talk about, briefly, we're maybe nearing the limits of our time here, but during the April anniversary show, you did Lou Reed's Perfect Day, which was a song that, you know, I wasn't a big fan of. I mean, I'd heard it in passing several times, but, you know, not maybe my kettle of, or my, not my cup of tea,
yeah.
generally speaking. But then, Berkur, you told this like amazing, most amazing digressive anecdote I've ever heard. You went on like a 20-minute digression relating to Johann Svartdalingur.
Yeah.
And I was wondering maybe if you could retell that in a very brief fashion, if that's possible. Just because
I can try.
You could try.
I can try. So
just so I preface, like, because
I mean, we have so many. There's so. Oh. How could I explain it? So obviously Perfect Day by Lou Reed is a song that most of us know and I've heard so many times. And after a certain experience I had, I kind of re-experienced the song.
Yeah.
And the experience was that I was in, I was traveling in Denmark and I was really, really just, biking around without any purpose, like without any specific, just on a,
during COVID.
And I saw a house that really just for no reason just really made me
freaked you out.
Yeah, it freaked me out.
Yeah.
That certain house, it really kept, like, you know, I had the image of that house. It was like it was haunting me. And then I came back home to Iceland, and I got trapped in a summer cabin. Because of COVID restrictions, and there was only one book in the cabin, and it was a book about this person you mentioned, Johann Svartdalingur, who was during his lifetime often called Johann Risi because he had a gigantism. He was an Icelandic giant who needed to, and it's a lot of mythology, and also just it's a very interesting tale. And this book was about him, and then I saw that. And the first thing I saw in the book was a picture of this house that I've seen in Denmark. And he was kept in that house while he needed to do shows in Denmark.
Like freak shows.
And this house is a very dark and horrible And then I was just reading about his life in that book, and I could see that he had a daughter in Denmark, where he used to live, before he moved to America, where he spent the rest of his life, except for the final year or so, which he spent in Iceland. So he had a daughter, young daughter, in Denmark, and he couldn't, it didn't work out with him and the mother, partly because of reasons that he was, festival or circus subject, you know. Yeah. He was, to say it bluntly, like he was a freak. Right. This didn't work out.
Yeah.
And but they spent always time in Fælledparken in Copenhagen before he moved to America.
Him and his daughter.
Yeah. And there was a picture taken of them, and the picture is in the book. And there is this line in Lou Reed's Perfect Day, because Lou Reed has this perspective, like he always speaks like he is a freak,
yeah,
and he was an outsider. That's why, you know, some of his music predates the punk movement, but it has the same kind of idea that he doesn't fit in, and you can feel it in the music and even in the both the cadence of how it delivers it, and also just the vocal itself. It's, yeah, almost like it's, you know, can't completely, you know, it's, yeah, not completely in tune. Sometimes it's always like a little bit off, and he's always like an outsider. And this line that I'm referring to in Perfect Day is that I thought I was someone else, someone good, and he's referring to that day in the park. Mm-hmm. And when I heard that line after all this, you know, reading about Jón Svarthöfði,
yeah,
I really felt, wow, this is the type of feeling that he might have when he looked at the photo of him and his,
right,
baby girl in a trailer somewhere in Florida.
Right. And yeah, I mean,
it's one perfect day.
You described, like, yeah, I mean, because Lou Reed's song is about, you know, spending a perfect day in the park, and, mm-hmm, and Johan presumably had a very similar experience, yeah, with his daughter in another park, yeah, across the pond. Mm-hmm. But
since then, just to put one extra layer on this.
Yeah.
So this was an episode, the one you attended, and it was, so two people have said that they have, one said that he was listening to this podcast and he was on the train in Copenhagen when he was listening to it. And he had, when he was hearing the story, the next stop was just by this Peter Liebke, whatever it is,
house. No way.
And another one said he was biking and he was just listening to that story. And while he was listening to the story, he just saw the house and he took a picture to prove it and sent it to me. And I thought that was really haunting. That must have been like an extra.
Yeah.
But this is just how it works, you know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's the great thing about, like, I wasn't a big fan of the song before the episode, but now, I just, like, yeah, when I hear it, I think of that story, and it's somehow so very poignant and heartbreaking that, mm, you know, the song is elevated to a whole new sort of.
Yeah, that's great.
And my family is actually from Svarðardalur. So yeah, my grandfather, he grew up with Johan, mm-hmm, Risi in some part.
Something,
but he used to tell the story of, I think Johan would come over for dinner every once in a while, and, you know, while everyone was gathered at the table sitting, Johan would have to sit in the stairwell because he was too, yeah, big. And it was just like this kind of heartbreaking image, yeah, of him, yeah, always being somehow apart. And I think when my grandfather was a baby, he would, like, Johan would stretch out his arms and let my grandfather, yeah, walk sort of the circumference, yeah, yeah, of his hand. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's a great thing also about consuming, you know, feel alike in Icelandic society, is that there are connections everywhere. You, yeah, know, you know people, and you're like, oh yeah, yeah, I've heard this and I have this. So, yeah, I think we're at the limits of our time. I have, yeah, a bunch of other questions, but, I think we pretty good. Yeah. So anything you would like to add or say, or additional comment?
Yeah. Just thank you, yeah, for your time. And
yeah, it's really nice.
Pleasure is all mine.
Yeah, and if you are, you can, because so many are foreign speakers,
yeah,
but you can see our TV shows in the excellent translation, yeah, of Ragnar.
Yeah.
In the
Iceland Air in flight.
Yeah, yeah.
On your way here.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Deep North is the official podcast of Iceland Review. Iceland's longest-running English-language magazine. Check it out wherever you listen to podcasts.